Imagine waking up one morning to discover your constitutional rights had been quietly undermined, not by your own government, but by international treaties you never voted on. This isn't dystopian fiction. It's the warning at the heart of the global war on your guns. Since the mid-1990s, a sophisticated international movement has been reframing gun ownership as a privilege granted by governments rather than an inherent right. When gun control advocates hit roadblocks in America, they didn't abandon their goals. They simply changed battlefields, moving to international forums where public scrutiny is minimal and democratic accountability nearly non-existent. The strategy is brilliantly effective. Create binding international agreements that pressure the U.S. to conform to global standards. While Americans might dismiss such threats as foreign concerns, these international norms could reshape American constitutional rights through judicial reinterpretation, executive agreements, or diplomatic pressure. The movement's vision is clear. Civilian ownership of firearms should be severely restricted worldwide, with no exceptions for American constitutional traditions. As Rebecca Peters, who leads the International Action Network on Small Arms, bluntly stated when asked what firearms Americans should own, Americans shouldn't be exempt from rules that apply to the rest of the world. Behind the scenes operates a sophisticated network coordinating the international gun prohibition movement. At its center is the International Action Network on Small Arms, IANSA, which coordinates over 500 organizations across 100 countries. What began as 33 NGOs in 1998 has grown into a formidable force with permanent staff and substantial funding. Working alongside IANSA is the Small Arms Survey, which publishes research from Geneva's Graduate Institute, presenting an appearance of objectivity while advancing an anti-gun agenda. The movement receives $5 to $10 million annually from Western governments and foundations like Ford, Rockefeller, and MacArthur. Unlike American gun control advocates who must win elections, these international organizations maintain a low profile while wielding extensive resources and government connections. What makes this movement concerning is its exclusion of opposing viewpoints. When the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue hosted a 2005 workshop, it rejected participation from legal firearm owners' representatives, yet presented its recommendations as consensus. After the Cold War, the UN disarmament establishment shifted focus from nuclear weapons to civilian firearms ownership, despite ongoing terrorism and nuclear proliferation concerns. This strategy emerged from a 1994 conference reframing guns as the core problem. The 1997 Ottawa Treaty banning landmines provided their template. NGOs drove international policy outside the UN system and won a Nobel Peace Prize, creating a simple logic: ban small arms and win another Nobel. Japan became a leading advocate following a 1992 shooting of a Japanese exchange student in Louisiana. By 1995, Japan had elevated gun control to the UN disarmament agenda, with the General Assembly passing its first small arms resolution that December. Expert panels then broadly defined small arms to include virtually all firearms. The resulting program of action included concerning provisions, reducing firearms numbers, extensive registration requirements, banning civilian possession of military-style weapons, and propaganda campaigns. While the U.S. blocked some extreme measures in 2001, UN efforts continue through various small arms projects. The UN's approach to civilian firearms ownership reveals a disturbing perspective. At the 2001 Small Arms Conference, posters proclaimed, "Small arms kill women and children," while delegates from Ireland demanded states suppress private ownership, and Jamaica advocated for global gun prohibition. The conference featured a massive sculpture of 7,000 welded firearms, symbolizing the UN's view that violence stems from objects requiring destruction. This demonization extended to Small Arms Destruction Day, with public burnings of firearms, reminiscent of historical book-burning events preceding human rights violations. UN officials routinely equate small arms with weapons of mass destruction. Former Secretary General Kofi Annan claimed they exacerbate conflict and spawn a culture of violence, blurring the distinction between weapons of war and self-defense tools. The UN's call for transparency is a euphemism for government firearms registries, which historically enabled confiscation in multiple countries. Their underlying objective is ensuring government monopolies of force, regardless of whether those governments are democratic or dictatorial. The threat to Second Amendment rights is developing through several concrete mechanisms. Supreme Court justices increasingly cite foreign law when interpreting the U.S. Constitution. Justice Breyer argues the Constitution must fit into governing documents of other nations, while Justice Stevens has cited EU opinions, endangering gun rights as activists fabricate international norms against civilian ownership. These supposed norms could be used in foreign courts where American manufacturers might be sued without Second Amendment protections. The UN's Special Rapporteur, Barbara Frey, argues that failure to impose certain gun controls constitutes a human rights violation, potentially exposing firearms companies to international litigation. Presidential agreements requiring only congressional majorities could implement international gun control, as could executive orders justified by signed but unratified treaties. In the UN's view, America's Second Amendment itself constitutes a human rights violation. Congress has repeatedly affirmed the Second Amendment as protecting individual rights, from the 1866 Freedmen's Bureau Act to the 2005 Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. The United Nations has repeatedly failed to prevent genocide. In some cases, its disarmament policies directly enabled mass killings. In Rwanda, civilian gun ownership was eliminated while the government remained armed. When General Dallaire warned of planned Tutsi extermination in 1994, Kofi Annan's office ordered him to stand down and later instructed him not to compromise impartiality during the genocide. After Yugoslavia's breakup, a UN arms embargo left Bosnian Muslims defenseless against well-armed Serb forces. Despite declaring Srebrenica a safe area, UN peacekeepers abandoned it when Bosnian Serb forces arrived, leading to over 7,500 executions. In Sudan, the UN refused to recognize the 2004 genocide while advocating for more gun control. Following the 1989 coup, Sudan's government killed 2.2 million in the south, and in Darfur, government-backed Janjaweed militias killed up to 400,000 while restrictive gun laws prevented civilians from acquiring self-defense means. The Second Amendment represents human freedom and self-determination. A global movement of 500 organizations across 100 nations seeks not just gun control, but expanded police powers threatening the entire Bill of Rights through surveillance and data collection. Two competing visions exist: self-defense as a natural right predating government versus a mere state-granted privilege. This right has deep roots across diverse philosophical traditions, including Greek, Roman, Jewish, Christian, Confucian, and Taoist. The stakes transcend politics. It's about whether individuals possess inherent rights governments must respect. When international bodies claim authority over constitutional protections, they challenge American sovereignty. The central question becomes, who determines Americans' rights? The people through their constitution, or unelected international bureaucrats? We face a choice between preserving hard-won freedoms or surrendering them to minimally accountable international governance. History shows that disarming civilians rarely enhances safety, but typically leaves them vulnerable. Defending constitutional rights requires vigilance both domestically and internationally.